regardless of how much money it is that Washington ends up doing.
We're going to start spending on infrastructure big.
It can't be done effectively without public-private partnerships.
Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie with Reason. Today we are talking with Stephen Goldsmith, the former mayor of Indianapolis, who has won the newest Reason Savvis Award for pushing public-private partnerships. Mayor Goldsmith, thanks for talking to us.
Sure.
You were mayor of Indianapolis from 1992 to 2000, special advisor to George W. Bush, deputy mayor of New York, and you're now a professor of government at Harvard's Kennedy School, and most recently the author of The Responsive City, which came out in 2014, and we'll talk about that in a second. At your time in Indianapolis, you saved taxpayers about $400 million by privatizing. What was the impetus for that? Where did the ideas come
from?
Right.
Well, I think we can answer that in two different ways. First, I became mayor. We had a structural deficit in the budget, and we had a Chamber of Commerce report saying we need $1 billion in infrastructure, and our property taxes were higher than our suburbs. Right, so you can't raise taxes, it's not good for the economy. We need to rebuild the infrastructure, so what do? Well, you become as efficient as you can, and the goal then was to reduce the operating costs of government and transfer that into an investment in the infrastructure of the future for the city. So those were the conditions. The ideas about how to get there, frankly, were from Reason. You know, Bob Poole spent, I don't know how many lunches in Indianapolis when I was running for mayor, and after I got elected, kind of going through A to Z and how to privatize
and
put those together.
You didn't just go through A to Z, you went through the phone book with A to Z, yeah. Right? And what was the rubric that you used to see whether or not the government should be the sole provider of a good or a service?
Right, so thanks. So the goal was not to privatize. The goal was to be as efficient and effective as possible. Sometimes that meant you continue to do things the way you all have always done, not very often, but sometimes. Other times it meant you would privatize the asset. Other times it means you set up managed competition so labor would have to bid on continuing to do the work they've done and become more productive. I generally found that if very sophisticated test, open up the phone book and the yellow pages, if there are three or more other businesses in the same area in your city, you're probably not the most efficient provider of those services, and we bid out or did managed competition over 80 times.
You know, many cities today in America obviously are, you know, facing structural deficits. Are they following the path that you blaze in Indianapolis? And if not, what's the biggest problem? Is it not knowing how to do that, or is it political interests getting in the way?
Right. I think the basic problem is an understanding of the goal, right? The goal isn't to monetize assets so you bring all of the revenues forward like parking meters and then spend it on operating. The goal is efficiency, right? So how do you operate something more efficiently? Is there anybody in the world better than you are in your city at operating streetlights or parking or golf courses or water or wastewater or airports? Then you take the savings and invest that in the future of the city. So I think the thing that's holding people back is they're thinking about it as, do we want to privatize? Do we want to sell the family jewels? As contrasted to, what is the role of government in terms of managing that asset?
What was a specific asset or thing that Indianapolis was doing, and how did you shift it into a more efficient mode?
Right, so we did about 80 of these, either managed competition or privatization. We did the first large wastewater privatization in the country. You know, today there are tens of billions of dollars of mandates against local and authorities for water and wastewater, EPA compliance and the like. So the city needs to clean its water, right? There are environmental responsibilities. Indianapolis at the time, according to Ernst & Young, was one of the most efficiently run wastewater treatment plants in the country. And yet, then we went ahead and asked for anybody in the world to give us a bid about how to manage our plant. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that the winning bidder had more PhDs than we had employees, right? There was no way that we were as effective as they were. There's no way we had the best technology, no way we had the best management. So essentially then, they managed the plants for about 25 to 30% less per year, which produced a savings that we could then use for debt or efficiency purposes for some other reason to invest it in the infrastructure of the city.
Were there any big mistakes that you made where either the privatization or failing to do that just blew up in your face?
Right. If you continue to do a mediocre service and don't change the status quo, you generally don't get criticized. Mm-hmm. If you try to change the status quo, let's say it's like this and you go like this, but you wanted to go like this, it's often viewed as a failure. Still better than it was before, but not as good. So one of the most important lessons we learned was benchmark everything before you begin. Mm-hmm. Benchmark in terms of quality and benchmark it in terms of cost. And occasionally we slipped up on that. The other issue, which I don't think is a mistake, but we did make mistakes, I mean, not a mistake in terms of we shouldn't have done it, is what are the service level requirements after you privatize the asset, right? What do you want the experience to be for passengers in the airport? What do you want the quality of the water to be? How high do you want the grass to be after you privatize the mowing of the medians? So get the service levels right, get the benchmarks right, have the numbers right, and then you can do it correctly, and occasionally you got those wrong.
Let's talk about the next frontiers in public-private partnerships or of making, I mean, actually it's more making government more efficient. How does The Responsive City, your 2014 book, deal with that, or what is that about?
So I think we're at a really interesting moment where public-private partnerships could blossom in a pretty dramatic way. So if we have technologies that are highly refined, let's say, go back to water and wastewater. So we put sensors in pipes. We know where the leaks are. We know where the pressure is. We know when the water hydrant is going to be low. You know, we can anticipate a problem and fix it before it occurs. We have a sensor on a bridge that says, this bridge is vibrating too much in Minneapolis, but you know, it's going to fall down if you don't come fix it, right? A street light that says, I'm about to burn out. Come fix me before I burn out, right? So the public-private partnerships and what we talk about in Responsive City is how to use data, how to use data analytics, how to use sensors in order to anticipate problems and solve them before they become serious.
What are the chief impediments to pushing forward on using big data, on using, you know, pushing this forward? Where's the resistance?
The impediments generally are perceived to be, is this hostile to labor? And our experience was it wasn't hostile to labor at all. In fact, our labor, as they became more productive, earned more money. What we said is we don't need as many managers and we need more technology. So as we look at the uses of technology, we're having a pretty high attrition and retirement rate in the public service, right, because of the age of the average public employee. So you don't have to lay off anyone. What we're basically saying to the employees is, as a result of partnering with the private sector, as a result of getting more technology, as a result of using predictive analytics and sensors, we can make your work more effective, therefore you win and the taxpayer wins.
And as workers in the public sector, like the private sector, generally as they become more productive, which technology helps with, they'll be paid more.
None of that $400 million we saved was from reducing the wages of employees. Employees attrited, they retired, they may have decided they didn't want to work as hard as the private sector made them work, the managers thinned out, but what happened is they became so much more productive that they could win and the taxpayers could win, and data and technology and mobile devices and the like let you do that today in ways that we hadn't even dreamed of.
Looking at a national level, Donald Trump has talked about a $1 trillion infrastructure investment program. Not clear what the details are or anything. Is that the type of thing that should be done exclusively through public-private partnerships?
Right. So if you look at public-private partnerships and you think about this $1 trillion, and everyone's a little confused about what the $1 trillion is, but somebody's got to pay back that money, right? The problem with infrastructure is not that you can't borrow the money. There's plenty of people willing to loan you the money, but a mayor or a governor has to pay the money back. So if we thought about public-private partnerships, the following things happen. A, there is money locked in those assets like water or wastewater or airports that could be taken out of operations more effectively and used for debt service they'll like. Two, if you do public-private partnerships, you build faster and less expensively and with more value engineering. And three, you have life cycle costing. So regardless of how much money it is that Washington ends up doing, and I don't know how much that will be, it can't be done effectively without public-private partnerships, both for purposes of paying back the money and for purposes of maintaining the asset.
And kind of getting the money in the first place, right? I mean, you can always borrow, but if there are firms that are willing to build roads or expand road capacity or take over water treatment, they're putting in a lot of the money, right?
Well, you have firms that are willing to put money into equity. They want to partially own these assets. Those same firms are saying, look, I'll maintain that asset for 20 years so you don't have to worry about me building it in an inferior way so that the cost of maintenance is transferred to the public sector. And also in terms of water and wastewater, airport privatization and the like, we see great new revenue sources that can be produced to help pay back those funds.
Is that one of the biggest lifts, though? I mean, it seems to me it's kind of like the shift from free TV to cable TV. You know, it was hard to do, and now nobody would ever go back to free TV. I mean, but is there a turn there that we have to make that's going to be hard to do?
Well, it'll be hard to do because there's a lot of support into the status quo, right? If anybody had any idea how inefficiently the public sector does capital assets, and I don't mean corruptly, I just mean efficiently. So you have a long procurement to hire somebody to design it, a long procurement to hire somebody to build it. Then somebody has to maintain it, probably the government, right? There are handoffs in each of those areas. And so all of those handoffs, all of that inefficiency can become more efficient. A public-private partnership says, here's the scope of what we want, the mayor says. You tell me how you're going to build it, how you're going to maintain it, how you're going to finance it. I'll decide whether the service levels are right, the fares are right, the fees or the tolls, and the service is right.
Well, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for talking to us. Mayor Stephen Goldsmith, the recipient of the 2017 Reason Foundation Office Award.
Thank you very much.
For Reason, I'm Nick Gillespie.